Freie Universität, Underground Station. Well, are you also going to the demonstration against the Vietnam War in the Auditorium Maximum at the university? You know, it's really important that we are as many as possible. The International Vietnam Congress is coming up soon, and we need a big lobby. Not everyone has to go on hunger strike like I did last year for the imprisoned Fritz Teufel, co-founder of Commune One. But you should at least be there. Why are you looking at me so questioningly? What? It's not 1968 when the Vietnam War was still to last another 7 years? To be honest, I imagine people from the 21st century to be more futuristic. You don't look any different than students who started in 1968. Well, your hair is a bit short, and I've never seen that glowing signaling device in your hand before. What's my name, you ask? Rudi Dutschke, of course. Almost everyone here knows me. I'm studying sociology, ethnology, philosophy, and history here at the Freie Universität, FU for short. Maybe I'll do a PhD, but I'll have to think about that carefully. By the way, after my Abitur, our school leaving exam, I was a sports reporter for the tabloid newspaper BZ, which belonged to the evil Axel Springer publishing house back then, as it still does today. Fortunately, I made it to the West before the Berlin Wall was built. And now I'm here, right in the middle of the 1960s student movement. Whether it's handing out leaflets, organizing rallies, or informing the good people about grievances in our society, I'm really trying to do everything I can to finally change something. Enough about me. You said you want to start your studies here next term? Well, then I'd be happy to show you around a bit here at the Dahlem Science and Research Campus. I'm very curious to see what has changed. Come on, let's walk towards the university and see what's going on. It really does look so different, and the cars, total madness. I hope you're not one of those establishment clowns, but you don't look like a member of the stuffy old guard to me. Did you know that this area is also called the German Oxford? Well, if we really are in the 21st century, as you claim, this center of science has now been around for more than 100 years. Just outside the hustle and bustle of the booming capital, here in this beautiful greenery, the Kaiser Wilhelm Society built the first German research campus in 1912. Even in your time, some of its former institutes are still part of today's Max Planck Society, named after the famous young man from Kiel, Max Planck, the Nobel Prize winner and founder of quantum physics. It is Germany's most successful research organization, with around 30 Nobel Prizes awarded to the researchers there. It is on a par with the world's best and most respected research institutions. You have to know, here in Dahlem, people are very proud of all these awards and titles. Well, a Nobel Prize is something special, after all. Let's now walk to various places that have decisively shaped Dahlem as a science location. And that will also play a central role in your future. The route will take us to some of the buildings of Freie Universität Berlin, the Museum Europäischer Kulturen and the past campus library in the direction of Domäne Dahlem. Harnack-Haus, Otto Suhr Institut, Rotes Café. Let's go, straight ahead onto Ine Straße. Look over there, on the left side of the street. Do you see the house with the white facade and the red roofs? That's Harnack Haus. Harnack Haus in Berlin-Dahlem opened for business in May 1929. It served as a clubhouse for the staff of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute on the campus and as a guest house for researchers from abroad. Tennis courts, a library, and inexpensive lunches soon made the house a central place for meeting up. Since its opening, celebrities from science, politics, and culture frequented it. Guests such as Albert Einstein and Max Planck were seen there. But also important political figures such as the Democratic Foreign Minister Gustav Stresemann or Hitler's armament organizer Albert Speer. The meeting place of scientists quickly developed into an intellectual and social center in Germany. Among them were, for example, Otto Hahn, Lise Meitner and Fritz Strassmann. Have you ever heard of them? They discovered nuclear fission in 1938 and thus laid a milestone in the history of modern physics and radioactivity research here in Dahlem. As I'm sure you know, that was also a turning point for man's approach to technology. We then experienced the effects of this with the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of the Second World War. Oh, how nice! The Otto Suhr Institute still exists. I've been to lectures there on the history of political ideas, on how communities of states deal with criminal law, and on international relations. You want to take queer studies? Well, there wasn't anything like that at the university in 1968. By the way, the institute is part of the Department of Political and Social Sciences and is named after Otto Suhr, a politician of the center-left party SPD, who, 10 years ago, was... Oh, sorry. Who, from 1955 to 1957, was the governing mayor of Berlin. If you want to study here in the future, you definitely have to get to know the Rote Café, or loosely translated, the Red Café. If we go around the corner now... Oh, hold on. Do you see that little red house? What for the radical left and other students is a beloved and important anchor point between university life and political activism is an object of hate for conservatives and liberals. The power of student protests is symbolized by the Red Café. In 1988, students occupied the institute building at Innestrasse 22 and set up a strike café in the basement. You can imagine that this caused quite a commotion. The university administration intervened and demanded that individuals responsible for the space be named in a contract. This, of course, displeased the occupiers, who saw themselves as self-governing. An escalating conflict ensued, culminating in the walling up of the entrance and a police eviction demanded by the university administration. This then led to the students becoming more cooperative in order to save their café. Oh, that's interesting. Your mobile phone contraption goes on to say that the students had to move to another location as a result of building work in 1998. This inconspicuous building was, of all things, a stable for laboratory animals for the Eugenics Institute during National Socialism. I once gave a presentation on the Eugenics Institute and the research carried out there. It is unbelievable what happened under the pseudoscientific so-called racial research and how much violence was legitimized by it. For example, forced sterilizations. Anyone can understand why the occupants decided to paint the facade of the building red. Over the years, the building was repeatedly the target of attacks. In the end, the group was forced to return to the starting point, where the history of the Red Café had begun 30 years earlier. Gosh, if only it had existed in my time. But we had other places and cafes where we partied and had heated discussions. But when it came down to it, we could still count on each other and unite against the dusty university system, the Grand Coalition, the Vietnam War, and for an honest coming to terms with the Nazi past. Today, the Red Café invites students to a campus rally at the beginning of the term, followed by an opening where beer, mulled wine, champagne and soft drinks can be consumed. It also hosts quiz nights, rallies against gentrification, lectures on political activism, and attracts students with delicious and wallet-friendly food.
Cheers!
Henry Ford Building. We now turn left into Gary Strasse and head for the Henry Ford Building, the most important building of the FU for ceremonies, events and festivities. You have to know that the university initially consisted of only two buildings on Boltzmannstrasse. Over time, other widely scattered and provisional locations were added, but this changed in 1954 with the Henry Ford Building. Finally, there was a main building with an adjoining library. In 1954, a position paper for the Berlin Senate confidently predicted that even after the removal of the sector's borders and after reunification, the local focus of the Berlin University will be in Dahlem. The western wing of the Henry Ford Building houses the university library with reading rooms, offices and an adjacent book stacks tower. In the eastern section, you will find lecture halls, conference rooms, and the meeting room of the Academic Senate. The listed building was completely renovated between 2005 and 2007. How would you describe the style of the building? Simple and straightforward always comes to mind when I stand in front of it. It was built between 1952 and 1954. According to the designs of the architects Sobotka and Müller in the new objectivity style. Formal buildings were giving way to functional building, with the goal being the functional city that would have a recognizable separation between living, working, and leisure areas. Can you think of other examples? The Hufeisensiedlung in Berlin-Britz and buildings such as Onkel Tom's Hütte or Uncle Tom's Cabin in Berlin-Zehlendorf are worth mentioning. In our days, the name Onkel Tom's Hütte is controversially discussed. Together with other styles, new objectivity in architecture belongs to the Neues Bauen or New Building movement. This refers in particular to those built-to-purpose works that later became famous as Bauhaus style or Bauhaus architecture. The architecture of the building was also intended to reflect the university's modern aspirations and convey these to the outside world. For this reason, it was decided that the building, which covers around 18,000 square meters, should have a completely glazed long side. The resulting high level of light coming into the building is intended to present the university's values of freedom, openness, and tolerance, as well as to reflect the building's motto of democracy as the builder. Famous people such as John F. Kennedy and Walter Gropius received their honorary doctorates from the FU and gave impressive speeches here. I tell you, when Kennedy was here, the auditorium maximum was almost bursting at the seams. Politics and this building have been closely connected since the very beginning. One eventful time was the student protests around 1968. Since I was a central figure in the movement, I can tell you firsthand about the developments. At first, we demanded the improvement of study conditions. A year later, we founded the Kritische Universität, a critical university, KU in short, a counter-model to the FU. That was really an exciting time. My fellow students simply couldn't stand the antiquated conditions anymore. We read all the writings of Karl Marx and organized ourselves into protest actions and general assemblies. One action in the evening of May 13, 1968 was particularly memorable. After a discussion event with the sociologist and philosopher Herbert Marcuse, the students tore the wooden seal of the university from the wall of the Auditorium Maximum here in the Henry Ford building and set it on fire in front of the door of the Vice Chancellor's office. This was an important movement for the protesting students. The burning seal symbolized the mustiness of the past. Among others, members of the Socialist German Student League and Commune One were involved. Have you ever heard of the West German Vice Chancellor's Conference in 1968? Its reform package was a small cause for celebration for us. It was supposed to lead to more democratization and modernization of universities, giving all members of a university a say and limiting the privileges of the untouchable university lecturers. Sounds great, doesn't it? In reality, of course, not all the promises were realized and not all our demands were met. Oh look, there are the remains of the university seal that was destroyed in 1968. Have you seen it? I always thought that it had been completely destroyed by the fire. Do you know who is the namesake of this imposing building? The building is a monument to the benefactors who helped the German youth in difficult times, said the then vice-chancellor and co-founder of the FU, Hans Kress von Kressenstein. Yes, that is, or was, his real name. According to official information, the building was named after Henry Ford's grandson, Henry Ford II, and the Ford Foundation. However, there have been repeated calls for the name to be changed, as a connection to the car maker Henry Ford himself can also be made. At that time, there was already a debate about the name of the building, since the inventor of Fordism was also co-editor of the influential anti-Semitic publication, The International Jew, and was, in 1938, awarded the Grand Cross of the Order of the German Eagle by the National Socialist Regime, the highest award for foreigners at that time. You were also able to put the Henry Ford building in your wallet from 1964 onwards. How? From that year on, the Henry Ford building was the motif of a permanent stamp issued by the German Federal Post Office. You've no doubt noticed that 1968 was a quite busy year. In the same year, an assassination attempt was made on me, which then triggered the so-called Osterunruhen or Easter riots. We will come back to this shocking moment in my life later. If you like, you can visit the exhibition on the history of the university inside the building. It has the promising title, The Future from the Beginning. Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics. A short detour to Boltzmannstraße brings us to the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science and the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics. The settlement of research institutes belonging to the Kaiser Wilhelm Society shortly before the First World War prepared the ground for the expansion of the academic campus in the southwest of the city. We'll now go past the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, or MPIWG for short, which was founded in 1994, and thus get to know one of more than 80 research institutes of the Max Planck Society. As the name suggests, the institute deals with the fundamental questions of the history of knowledge, from the Stone Age to the present. After all, your time has some exciting developments with all its new technical inventions. The researchers investigate the scientific and cultural conditions of evidence-based knowledge during the history of mankind. Yes, that's right. That's quite a long period of time, offering all kinds of objects of investigation from all epochs and all continents. For example, some work on Babylonian mathematics or the understanding of nature in ancient Greece, while others deal with modern neuroscience. Fascinating, isn't it? The focus is always on the categories of thought, proof and experience, as well as the questions of why and how the meaning of basic scientific concepts changes over time. Of course, the changing practices of experimentation and argumentation are also interesting. Their work is not only important for the recording of historical topics. By analyzing scientific thought and action as historical phenomena, the Institute also creates reflections for current challenges in the sciences. Have you already spotted the building with the distinctive onion-shaped tower? This is where the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics was based from 1936 to 1946. Let's now take a closer look at the fascinating history of the Institute, which is highly regarded both inside and outside Germany. It all began in Albert Einstein's dusty and cluttered study. The small attic at Haberlandstraße 5 in Berlin-Schöneberg was the first address of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics, which did not have its own building in the beginning. Astonishing, isn't it? The Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics was founded in 1917, in the middle of the First World War, with the aim of financially supporting research. One of the first grants went to the young professor Peter Debye. He received 16,030 marks to purchase a powerful X-ray apparatus. 2 decades later, Debye received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his research. When you hear the word institute, you naturally think of a team of scientists. But in the beginning, there was only one scientific staff member, Erwin Freundlich, in addition to the director, Albert Einstein himself. Freundlich, an astronomer, was involved in testing the general theory of relativity. From the 1930s, the institute developed into a research institute in its own right. The building was constructed in 1936 with the support of the Rockefeller Foundation. It was the first building of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics. Even then, the name Max Planck Institute was emblazoned in gold letters above the main entrance of the institute, while the designation Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics was only inspicuously chiseled into the door frame. This was intended as a tribute to Max Planck, but was probably, not unjustifiably, also understood as a political affront to the monarchy. You must know, it took some time before the institute finally changed its name. Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicated in 1918 and Germany received a democratic constitution for the first time in its history. Nevertheless, the Senate of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, KWG for short, decided in 1919 not to rename the society named after him. During the Weimar Republic, Reichstag members, particularly those with the left-wing parliamentary groups, repeatedly tried to push through a name change. The overwhelming majority of those working in science did accept the new democracy, but they remained monarchist at heart. I would now like to tell you more about the Institute under National Socialism. The cooperation with the Nazi regime shows the less glamorous part of the renowned Institute's history. The establishment of National Socialist rule was followed by numerous anti-Jewish laws. In April 1933, the law for the reintroduction of the professional civil service was passed, and in the course of this, employees with a Jewish family background were expelled from state positions. In the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, too, a wave of dismissals began with 126 layoffs, the majority of which affected the academic staff. While some were able to continue their careers abroad, other emigres lost their livelihood and the possibility to continue their research. Four of those dismissed were deported and murdered in concentration camps. One physicist, who initially opposed the expulsion of his Jewish colleagues at the beginning of the National Socialist regime, was the later director Werner Heisenberg. Following his refusal to sign his name on a list swearing loyalty to Hitler, he came into the sights of the National Socialists and became the target of a group that, as representatives of an Aryan physics, opposed his allegedly Jewish-infiltrated quantum physics. In 1937, he was defamed in the SS newspaper Das Schwarze Korps, or the Black Corps, in an article about white Jews and science. Nevertheless, he decided to stay in Germany. In July 1942, Werner Heisenberg was finally appointed director of the Institute. As he took office, he was already considered one of the most important physicists of the 20th century. 10 years earlier, he had been awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the foundation of quantum mechanics. Heisenberg expanded the research program to include cosmic radiation and elementary particle physics. During the Second World War, Heisenberg headed the uranium project of the German Army Weapons Office. The aim was to research the possible uses of nuclear fission. In his position as director, he continued the large-scale experiments. Shortly before the end of the war, the Allies arrested him and other atomic researchers and brought them to Great Britain. After the war, Heisenberg was controversial because of his career under National Socialism. Nevertheless, he took up his position as director at the Institute in Göttingen, now called the Max Planck Institute for Physics, in 1946. What do you say to that? In 1958, the Institute moved to Munich and later split into the Max Planck Institute for Physics, called the Werner Heisenberg Institute, and those for plasma physics, for astrophysics, and for extraterrestrial physics. In October 2017, the Max Planck Institute for Physics, MPP for short, celebrated its 100th anniversary. And 1 year later, Professor Dr. Julia Zandarigi became the first woman director at the Institute. She heads the department Innovative Computational Methods in Particle Physics. Hahn-Meitner Building. To reach our next destination, we have to go back to Gerichstraße and from there up Thielallee and past Korenzplatz. Have you already discovered our next stop, the Hahn-Meitner Building? I would now like to explain to you why this building is called the Hahn-Meitner Building. The name goes back to the chemist Otto Hahn and the physicist Lise Meitner. The building in which the two worked for more than 2 decades and in which Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann succeeded in proving atomic nuclear fission now houses parts of the Institute of Chemistry and Biochemistry of the Freie Universität. The physicist Lise Meitner was born in Vienna in 1878. In 1907, she came to Berlin to continue her research on radioactivity with Max Planck, and it was here that her collaboration with Otto Hahn began. From 1912 onwards, Meitner was, at the beginning unofficially, Max Planck's co-worker at the Kaiser Wilhelm Society's newly founded Institute for Chemistry in Dahlem. After the First World War, she headed the physical radioactive department there, and was later also a professor at Berlin University. As a Jewess, however, she could no longer carry out this activity from 1933 onwards, and she became increasingly threatened. After Austria's annexation by Germany, she lost her Austrian citizenship and decided to flee to Sweden via Holland. She kept up her correspondence with Otto Hahn and was thus still involved in the research despite of everything. Otto Hahn was finally awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1944 for the discovery of nuclear fission. Lisa Meitner, however, was denied public recognition, despite her decisive scientific contributions. The Hitler regime recognized the potential of nuclear fission to build an atomic bomb, just as the Allies recognized the risk that Germany could develop such a bomb here in Dahlem. That's why in 1944 they deliberately bombed the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Chemistry building and what is now the Hahn-Meitner building. Are you wondering what happened to Lisa Meitner? After the war, she received numerous research offers from the USA, but she turned them all down. She did not want to work on an atomic bomb project under any circumstances. From 1947, she was head of the Department of Nuclear Physics at the Stockholm Institute of Technology. She never married, as her life was completely devoted to physics. In 1960, she moved to Cambridge to live with her nephew Otto Robert Frisch. She died there in 1968, the same year as Otto Hahn passed away. She was honored with numerous awards during her lifetime. In 1992, the element with the atomic number 109 was named Meitnerium, symbol MT, in her honor, so to speak as a late compensation for not being awarded the Nobel Prize. Today, the Institute has technical departments with their own training workshops for the development and construction of experimental measuring electronics, as well as for the planning and construction of the experimental buildings. Via Zehnerpark and Hittorfstraße to the Rost and Silberlaube building complex, with a visit to the Freie Universität Berlin Norman Foster Library. With the so-called silver and rust arbors, you will now get to know other important buildings that future FU students simply have to know about. And no, I'm not talking about some weathered garden arbor. The Rost and Silberlaube building complex is home to subjects from the humanities and social sciences, as well as numerous other university facilities, such as the new Holzlaube or wooden pergola, Mensa 2 or Canteen 2, the Philological Library designed by the world-famous architect Norman Foster, and the former Departmental Library of Education Sciences, now called the Campus Library. The building complex started with an architectural competition in the 1970s, entitled Institutskomplex Obstbaugelände or Institut Complex Fruit Orchard. This was won by the architectural firm Candilis Josic Woods Schiethelm, which collaborated with the French architect and designer Jean Prouvé. You may be wondering what the origin of the name is. The name came from the fact that fruit was originally grown there. After the university buildings were completed, the name Humanities Institutes became established, until the unofficial nicknames Rostlaube or Rust Pergola and Silberlaube or Silver Pergola finally became official. For the exterior facade, the weatherproof and then still novel material called Corten steel was chosen. This special material had only one drawback. It rusted quickly, and even the special steel alloy that was applied as a countermeasure could not completely prevent this natural process. The competition design originally envisaged an even larger building. From 1967 to 1973, a first construction phase was realized with the Rostlaube made of Corten steel, completing about one-third of the design. In the course of that work, however, the architect's office, Candilis Josic Woods, was broken up. The Rostlaube is sometimes referred to as the most important building of structuralism. A few years later, further disciplines such as Roman studies and the newly built Central Language Laboratory of the growing university had to be accommodated in the building complex at Habelschwerter Allee 45. And so, the second third of the building project was realized at the end of the 1970s. Can you guess why this part bears the name Silberlaube or Silver Pergola? Exactly, the name is due to the building's imposing outer skin made of aluminum. The Silberlaube extends the Rostlaube building section in a northeasterly direction. The Department of Education and institutions such as the Dahlem Research School, the Dahlem Humanities Center and the Italy Center also found a new location here. If you're hungry, you find the canteen nearby. It's located northwest of the Rostlaube, directly on Otto von Simson Straße and Rudi Dutschke Weg. It's crazy, even whole streets are named after me. I would now like to show you more of the Norman Foster Library. The building measures 64 meters in length and towers 19 meters high into the sky. In 1997, the British architect and designer Norman Foster won the competition for the building project, which had been put out to public tender jointly by the State of Berlin and Freie Universität Berlin, and built the library in 2005. If you're looking for a book in the field of Indology, English studies, philosophy, Slavic studies, or Latin American studies, you will certainly find what you are looking for here. The Philological Library offers a wide range of books in the fields of linguistics and literature. What does the outer shape of the building remind you of? Yes, it's true. When you stand in front of it, it's hard to see. But from a bird's eye view, it resembles a huge, silvery drop that has fallen into the courtyard. A beautiful image, isn't it? The building reminds others of the shape of a brain, so it is also called the Berlin Brain. I think that's somehow more fitting for a university library. Come on, let's go inside. It really is an impressive piece of architecture, both from the outside and the inside. Through the partially transparent fiberglass fabric surfaces, Foster directs our gaze outwards and upwards towards the sky. The white fabric membranes, which are made of environmentally friendly polyester, filter the sunlight, creating a bright working atmosphere. So you find the best conditions for a productive learning atmosphere, which you're sure to need during your studies. How many books do you think you can fit in this building? There is actually a storage capacity of 800,000 books here. We are now leaving the world of books and diving into the diversity of cultures. Continue on Fabeckstraße and via Arnimallee to the Museum of European Cultures. Our tour continues along Fabeckstraße and Arnimallee to the Museum of European Cultures. Which cultures can be found in Europe? How can national and linguistic borders be overcome? And what commonalities can we discover? These are the questions that the Museum of European Cultures addresses. The museum team itself describes the work of the museum and the themes reflected in the exhibitions with the term cultural contacts. The highlights of the museum are, for example, the football jersey of the former national player Mesut Özil, a Ramadan calendar, a splendidly decorated farmer's cupboard from the 19th century Sweden, and a frightening Perchten mask from the 18th century as it is still used today in the Austrian pre-Christmas season. It's great that a museum is able to establish a connection between historical collections and current topics that influence politics and society. Important aspects here are the close cooperation with the respective communities and the interaction with visitors. Collecting, researching, preserving, presenting, and communicating components of very different European cultures from the 18th century to the present day are thus at the heart of the museum's work. I believe that this mission promotes mutual understanding. Respect for and tolerance of foreign cultures prevent wars and are elementary for a peaceful future. You can see how important such museums are. So I can highly recommend a visit. In addition to the collections and changing exhibitions, various interesting events such as the annual European Culture Days, the Textile Day, and the Fête de la Musique also attract visitors. The museum team presents various cultures and cultural techniques from Europe. From arts and crafts to music and culinary delights, and invites you to explore them. On the website, you can find out about open workshops where you can learn to braid and about interesting exhibition conversations with the curators or contemporary witnesses. Such websites are really very practical. And you can see them on your mobile telephones, you say? That really is amazing. Julius Kühn Institute, Botanical Garden. Our next stop is the Julius Kühn Institute. It's quite easy to find if we just continue to follow Arnimallee. You've never heard of it? The Julius Kühn Institute, or JKI for short, is the Federal Research Center for Cultivated Plants. As an independent higher federal authority, it belongs to the Federal Ministry of Food and Agriculture. The JKI has several locations consisting of different specialist institutes. Three major areas are represented: plant genetic diversity with breeding research, the protection of cultivated plants, and research into agricultural ecosystems. At this location, you will find the Institute for Ecological Chemistry, Plant Analysis, and Stock Protection, as well as the Institute for Bee Protection. There's also a library and a 7.1-hectare experimental field, which was established in 1898 on the grounds of Domäne Dahlem, right next to the new buildings, which were still under construction at the time. A special feature of this field is that consumer protection studies are being carried out here on pollutant and heavy metal contamination in urban areas and the effects this has on crops and groundwater. Another highlight in this area is, of course, the botanical garden, which is not far from here. At any time of the year, the extensive grounds, the 15 show greenhouses and the main tropical greenhouse offer a little time out. Especially in the main tropical greenhouse, the plant world, including giant bamboos and lianas, almost makes you feel like you're in Africa, Asia, Australia, or America. You will see that the plants in the greenhouse are arranged geographically according to their occurrence in the continents. How many plant species do you think you'll find in the 43-hectare area? There are about 20,000, making Berlin's botanical garden not only one of the largest, but also one of the richest in terms of species. Its history goes back to the first plant collections in the Berlin Palace in the 16th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, these collections, which had meanwhile developed into scientific living collections, were to be made accessible to the public. From 1897 to 1910, the garden was laid out according to the plans by architect Alfred Körner and under the direction of the garden director Adolf Engler and moved to Dahlem. Do you know where it was before? Where the Heinrich von Kleist Park in Schöneberg is today. Along Königin Luise Straße to Dutschke's grave. I would now like to show you a sad place. The St. Annen Cemetery, which you reach via Königin Luise Straße. Now that I have learned something frightening about my own future in your time, I can also tell you the end of my life story. From the entrance at the junction of Königin Luise Straße and Pacelli Allee, walk around the church to the left until you reach the northern side. There, quite centrally, is the grave of honor where I was buried on a cold, gray winter day in January 1980. Yes, you heard right. I unfortunately died in Denmark at the age of only 39 from the after effects of the assassination attempt. What assassination attempt, you ask? On Maundy Thursday, 1968, I was shot and seriously injured in the street by 23-year-old Josef Bachmann. Bachmann, a right-wing nationalist auxiliary worker, was later sentenced to 7 years in prison. I only barely survived the assassination attempt. After several difficult operations, I had to relearn even basic skills like reading and speaking. I then went to England and taught from 1971 onwards as a guest lecturer in Aarhus, Denmark, commuting between Denmark and Germany. There I campaigned for the preservation of human rights and finally received my PhD in 1973 with a thesis on the difference between the Asian and Western European paths to socialism here in beautiful Dahlem. So, in the end, I also had one of those nice PhDs. Following this, I received a research grant from the German Research Foundation at the FU. However, I renounced it, preferring to devote myself to political activism again. I went on many lecture tours and was part of the anti-nuclear demonstrations. Then, in 1979, the consequences of the assassination attempt caught up with me. The severe brain injuries led to my death from an epileptic seizure. But I'm very pleased that even in your present day, decades after the act, the assassination attempt is commemorated with a memorial plaque in front of the house on Kurfürstendamm in Berlin. The place of burial was not at all certain at first, as there was no free grave available in this beautiful cemetery. This grave you are standing in front of is not just any grave. It was intended for Pastor Martin Niemöller. He was a resistant fighter under National Socialism and, after the war, church president of the Protestant Church in Hesse and Nassau. Because Niemöller had been a parish pastor in Berlin-Dahlem from 1933 to 1937, there was still this reserved gravesite for him there. After consultation with my wife, Gretchen Dutschke-Klotz, however, the theologian was willing to leave his intended grave to me and praised my life's work. Gretchen processed the early loss of me in the biography, "We Had a Barbarically Beautiful Life." A great title, isn't it? Destination, Dahlem Dorf Underground Station. Enough of my life story. Our tour is now coming to an end. At the Dahlem Dorf underground station, I will have to leave you. From here, you can visit the nearby Domäne Dahlem, a very special place in this otherwise hectic capital. In this open-air museum, you can take a break from the stressful everyday life of a student. The only organic farm in the world with its own underground connection. The unique museum project of Domäne Dahlem combines agriculture with exciting exhibitions and interactive knowledge transfer. Can you imagine that fields have been cultivated here for 800 years? You can not only learn about cultivation of food here, but also eat it fresh from the field. The large-scale open-air museum aims to give interested visitors an understanding of a typical everyday farm life as well as historical facts. Already in the Middle Ages, Domäne Dahlem was a well-known knight's estate and has been farmed by various owners over the centuries. After the Second World War, a passionate initiative of the people of Berlin fought for the preservation of the farm. They prevailed and founded the unique open-air museum. From the beginning of the museum's work until today, the association also organizes events such as nostalgic markets and medieval festivals with stick bread made on the campfire and hearty stews. You can start your tour of the Domäne Dahlem Museum in the terracotta-colored manor house from 1560, where a historic grocery store has been reconstructed. A special highlight is the image of a clerk projected onto glass who advises visitors on their purchases. In the traditional workshops, you can learn about various crafts such as blacksmithing or restoring furniture. You can also discover the Armbruster Room with information on bee culture and the life of bee expert Professor Dr. Ludwig Armbruster. Feel free to drop by at Domäne Dahlem. But if you want to move on quickly, you can easily get back to the city center by underground. Unfortunately, I have to say goodbye to you now. I hope you have enjoyed our tour and are looking forward to your studies and discovering the world of science here in beautiful Dahlem.